Welcome to the Texas Crime Cast by the Dallas Morning News. I'm Jen Emily. This week we talk about the unusual marriage of the terrible and the trendy in Waco. We examine whether Waco is losing the wacko image cultivated for years with tragedies like the deadly standoff between Branch Davidian leader David Koresh and his followers with law enforcement that led to the deaths of 80 people, including children. There is now an element of cool in some parts of town, mainly promoted by the HGTV show Fixer Upper at their shop Magnolia. Then just last year, 9 people died in a shootout between 2 biker gangs at Twin Peaks. My co-hosts today are reporter Naomi Martin and photographer Smiley Poole. Also joining us in the studio is Assistant Director of Photography for the News, Erwin Thompson. He photographed the Branch Davidian siege and captured images of the burning compound that remain embedded in our collective memories. Editorial writer Mike Hashimoto will end the show in our usual way with his latest Hashing It Out segment with questions about how police and prosecutors have handled the aftermath of the Twin Peaks shooting.
I'm wacko, I'm wacko, ain't no doubt about it. Shot a man there in the head, but can't talk much about it. He's trying to shoot me, but it took too long to aim. Anybody in my place would have done the same. I don't start fights, I finish fights, that's the way I'll always be. I'm wacko, I'm wacko, you best not mess with me.
In case you couldn't tell, that song was called Wacko from Waco. It's by country music legends Billy Joe Shaver and Willie Nelson. The song is about Waco's checkered past, but also a real-life incident where Shaver shot a man in the face, and then he convinced a jury that he acted in self-defense because, after all, the guy did have a knife, and that acquittal happened in Waco. So, everybody, why does Waco have such a checkered past? I mean, we've talked a little bit about the Branch Davidians already, but beyond that, and even including that, what do you guys know about Waco, and why is it called Wacko?
Well, I think that's pretty well summed up by the legion of people coming in and out of the Magnolia Market, who we interviewed last week when we were working on this story.
What did they say?
Well, you ask them, they say, what was the direct quote? The one gentleman said that what did you know about Waco before you came here? And he said, the cult thing.
Yeah, he really did. And Smiley and I went down to Waco. We spent 2 days and we went to the Branch Davidian compound. We went to the Magnolia Market, which is the shop owned by the host of Fixer Upper, Joanna and Chip Gaines. And it's this cool, trendy place. You can park for $10 at a parking lot across the street from the church. It's not owned by the Magnolia, but it's like $10. I don't want to pay that much when I go to a Rangers game. I try to get, $7 and then walk a little more.
So what are the theories that people have about why Waco is so wacko?
There's a lot of theories. There's the idea that it's along 35. It's right between Austin and Dallas, that you have this idea of you have the university, you have the town in the gown, so to speak. And it's mostly because it's been a place that welcomed outsiders. Great when it brings you a thriving Czech community. Very bad when it brings you David Koresh. And, maybe there's something in that part of the Brazos. I don't know.
I do love the Czech bakeries that they have along 35 with the kolaches.
Yeah, we stopped on the way home on one of our trips.
It's kind of a prerequisite when you make a trip down to Waco to bring kolaches back to this particular office.
It really is. And we were going to stop on the second trip, but it was really late and we were really tired. And we both had to get up in the morning to go to the courthouse for Johnny Manziel, which has nothing to do with Waco.
Yeah, he's no RG3.
He is no RG3, who loves Waco, by the way. I talked to him this week and he still goes back there as part of his Family of Three Foundation, but also because he says he loves Waco and he goes to his favorite restaurants, George's, which we ate at, Barris, and he talked about throwing tortillas off the bridge to feed the ducks. And he said, at Waco, when you're at Baylor, especially when you're a football player at Baylor, you live in a bubble. But he tried to go out and meet people. And he goes back to those restaurants for the food, but also because of the people. And he said, these are the people who knew me before I was RG3. And those are the people you hold near and dear. So he's a big fan of Waco, and not just because they have a statue of him outside the new $250 million stadium, but because, you know, he grew up there. He went there when he was 17, which, you know, he'd already done quite a bit of growing, but he became an adult there. And now he's with the Cleveland Browns. Waco's weird history goes back even further than that. There's a museum called the Redmond Museum. Is that right? Is that right, Smiley?
Yeah, it's the Order of the Redmen.
Order of the Redmen, yes. And we went there too. And we were looking for, they supposedly have a painting by Adolf Hitler. And we thought, that's really, really weird. But we never found it. And it had been on loan there at one point. And we thought that would be another weird thing. But instead, we found that they have these guns displayed. And Smiley, you've photographed those. So talk a little bit about those guns. Do you remember?
Well, it's the dueling pistols from, correct me if I'm wrong, 1897?
Yeah, late 1890s. 95, 97, somewhere in there.
When, as the current sheriff spoke colorfully about, is, you know, we're talking about an era where dueling was absolutely legal exercise in terms of settling a dispute.
And you had to have a second,
yep,
in case the other guy shot first.
Yep. And so, you know, we're going back to the late 1800s where there were, you know, where a judge is involved in a duel in the middle of what is now downtown Waco. So you go way back. You go way back to it was Indian territory, and there's a history there. You go back to the prehistoric with, you know, mass death of mammoths out on the Brazos, which is now a national historical site.
Yeah, it's a national monument, and you can go there. And this was discovered in the 70s, and so they took some of the mammoth bones away, and they found a family of 16 mammoths, which is, on a global scale, an unusual find. And some of the fossils are in a museum, but you can go to the national monument, go inside, and find and look at the fossils of the mammoths still as they were found. And it's really an unusual thing to be able to see. And it's in Waco. And so, of course, it's something that for the mammoths in prehistoric times was obviously a tragedy. They died. But now is part of this new cool factor in Waco. I mean, it brings you this very cool science thing that kids will want to see, adults will want to see. And it just became a national monument last year. So it's very new to Waco as far as the monument, but the mammoths were discovered quite a while ago.
So interesting things have been happening at that little spot on the river for a long time.
So was there anything that really shocked you guys on your trip?
Everything seems to revolve around Chip and Joanna Gaines.
Everything. The show is popular not just with tourists who are flying in or driving in to see it, but people around town.
What do they do? I haven't seen this show.
It's called Fixer Upper, and they help you find a house, which is in a normal price range. Like, people watch it, and it's like, you know, most people can see that as something that they could afford. And it's a choice between three houses usually, and you pick the house, and it has good bones. You know, the structure is good. And then they renovate it for you. And it becomes this beautiful, beautiful home.
So it doesn't have to be in Waco. It can be anywhere.
Well,
or do you have to live in Waco?
Has to be around Waco. And so that's why it has been such a draw for Waco. And some of the people who live in town told me, you know, we watch the show and we try to figure out where the house is. You know, where are they filming? Or, like, can we see a street sign? And it's this pop culture phenomenon that gives people something else to see, put in their memories about Waco other than the Branch Davidian fire. And I think even if you weren't born at the time, you know, you've still seen the picture. And people who live in Waco will tell you, as the sheriff told us, as this Baylor professor who took us on a tour around town told us, the Branch Davidians aren't in Waco. They're miles outside of town, but
they're trying to disown them.
Yeah.
Well, and who wouldn't?
Who wouldn't? And but the thing is, the world declared it Waco a long time ago. And if you go to the compound, which I don't know that I would necessarily say is a thing you should do, you can see there's a monument there to the people who died. And at their chapel, they have these little pamphlets. And on the front, it says Waco in all capital letters. So they clearly consider themselves Waco. And there's a lot of, I think, wanting to forget the Branch Davidians in Waco. And that's why people are so thrilled that Magnolia, Fixer Upper, Chip and Joanna Gaines are bringing this new light on Waco.
And I think a lot of new people to town. That was the thing that kind of struck me was, there's carload after carload after carload of people going into the Magnolia Market who had never conceived that they would stop their car in Waco, Texas. And they've made it a destination.
Actually, some of these people are moving to Waco just to buy a house so that the fixer-uppers can actually come in and do it. So it's pretty crazy.
Wow.
It's
a
crazy
that is
culture.
Commitment.
I mean, I'm not moving to Waco, but I would love for them to come to my house or help me buy a different
house.
Waco. Yeah.
Well, and the thing about the show is it's a window into actual people living their actual lives.
I just wanted to say go to dallasnews.com and search under the business section, and you'll find some amazing pictures and stories by the Dallas Morning News staff that's awesome about the fixer-uppers.
Great. Yeah, and one other point on that, one thing that I did take away was Maria in one of those stories, referenced that Joanna is like the new Martha Stewart.
Right.
And
huge.
And, I was like, okay, whatever. And now that you see the crowds flocking to that market, you're like, I get it now.
We were there on a Monday in the middle of the day, and there had to be at least 200 people shopping inside the store. It's the size of a warehouse. And then there's all these people outside. There's a play area for kids where they have bikes, they have balls, not bikes, and swings and hula hoops, and, you can run the bases. And there's food trucks with crepes and pizza and coffee. So it's not just shopping, it's an event. And this is on a Monday. It wasn't spring break. It wasn't summer. It's not summer yet. So it's kind of
it was a gray, ugly Monday. And it was a happening place.
Yeah. It really was. This is why when the Twin Peaks shooting happened, I mentioned Baylor professor Robert Darden, who took us on a driving tour. He, when the shootout happened and he heard about it, his heart sank. And let's hear a little bit about that.
You don't see Wichita Falls or Plano, or you don't see Midland or Beaumont in the news. It's Waco. And all around the world, you can say Waco and people automatically have images. I think now there's more Fixer Upper than there are David Koresh. But like we say, what's next? What are we going to overcome?
Naomi, you were out at Twin Peaks the day that the shootings happened. Can you tell us a little bit about what that was like and what you saw?
Yeah, it was extremely surreal. It was a Sunday afternoon, and I was the lone cops reporter in Dallas. And, found out about the shooting, 9 dead, drove to Waco, and it's a shopping complex, a lot of stores that everyone knows, like Old Navy and Panera, and it was just completely closed off by like federal agents wearing like FBI vests, holding big rifles, and they weren't allowing anyone in except media. And when we got there, it was just crazy to see dozens of bikers sitting on the ground wearing these, their biker vests and their gear. And they were just sitting there for hours being processed because there were 177 who ended up getting arrested. And so it took police a long time to search them for weapons. And they were going methodically one by one, searching them. And they said they ended up finding you know, thousands of weapons or hundreds at least. So it was a long process. Everyone was very on edge. There was a sniper on the roof of Twin Peaks, and they were worried. The officers kept telling us they were worried that more bikers were coming in. There were reports that there had been like calls put out to the biker gangs to come into Waco and attack law enforcement and attack the bikers still there. So there was that concern. And I ended up staying at a hotel right by the scene where the FBI was also staying. And so they were telling us at the hotel lobby how they were working these 24-hour around-the-clock shifts trying to guard the scene and worried about these potential retribution, retaliatory attacks. It was extremely surreal. Also, the other thing that I will mention is that when the shooting broke out, it was around lunchtime, and there were families who had gone to church that day eating at the Don Carlos, you know, Mexican restaurant right next to where Twin Peaks is. And so they were, you know, trying to enjoy their Sunday lunch, and this mass shooting broke out, you know, kind of a wild, wild west thing right in the middle of an outdoor mall there. So that was a crazy experience, obviously. I would love to hear, you know, what did you guys hear anything more from people about the residual effects of Twin Peaks?
People really didn't talk about Twin Peaks. It's almost like, not that it didn't happen in Waco, but their take on it is, this is just a place along the highway. It was convenient for people from the Dallas area, convenient for people from the Austin area to meet up. That it had, you know, I guess the take is it had nothing to do with Waco. It's, you know, it just, we happened to be the place that they stopped.
But they're having to, you know, put a ton of resources into now prosecuting these guys. I mean, the community must care a little bit about what happens.
Yeah, it's, they just really didn't talk about it. I mean, it was really Branch Davidians and Magnolia. That was that's the scale that they operated on. And other than really Professor Darden, who was kind of like, really, you know, come on, we've made such progress. And there wasn't a lot of chatter about it. And obviously the police and prosecutors are having to put a lot of resources in it. Of those bikers who were arrested, 154 have been indicted. It's all the same indictment.
Which is a huge number.
That's a lot of people.
For one incident.
Yeah. And it's a small county, too. And so there's a lot going on in court about these cases. There's no trial dates. They're still testing evidence. The defense attorneys are questioning the indictments because they do all look the same. There's nothing specific that X defendant did versus Y defendant. And, you know, they're questioning whether the trial should even be held in Waco. And should all of these people even be charged? And so it's all going to be a long legal fight.
Sounds like a mess.
Yeah, it is. It is a mess.
Erwin, tell us about what you saw when you went there for the Branch Davidians.
Yeah, that was in February 28, 1993. It was a 51-day siege. I was there probably 40 of those days. I didn't get there on day one, but I got there probably on day three or four. And it's like, you know, no hotel rooms because all the ATF agents had the hotel rooms, slept in the car for at least a week and a half. And you sit right outside of the compound, which was still a half a mile away, you know, but you stayed. I mean, it's like a media camp, and you slept in your car and you slept with your camera around your neck because you never knew if they were going to bring David Koresh out, you know, every day. I mean, any car goes in and come out, all the photographers and videographers was there by the window trying to get that picture because you didn't want to miss it. If he came out of there, you better have it.
Yeah.
So,
or you'd be in trouble.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And that was the craziness of it at the beginning. And then it kind of gotten old. You know, it was cool first, you know, for the first three or four days. But after that, after you sit there for three or four weeks, you're chasing everything. You're chasing different stories. So I stayed out there probably for two or three weeks, non-eventful, you know, came back for a week, went back. Came back at the end, and I was got back on a Friday night, and we had a call. We had a tip that it was going to go down on that Monday morning. So since I've been there the longest, they sent me back because they wanted me to get the shot. But before I got the shot, like doing probably about the fourth week, I think it was William Snyder, Ken Geiger. Ken Geiger had me go around the compound like within 4 or 5 miles and check it out, and I was able to find a farmer that let us build a scaffold three and a half stories high. And on that scaffold, we would climb up there, and we had a Canon lens, what it was, 800, I think, or 1200, f8, and that thing was probably a, give me a size, Smiley, that thing's...
Well, if it's the 1200, it's you got to have a minivan for that lens.
It's crazy.
Yeah, literally.
Looks like bigger than a basketball.
Yeah. So, oh, yeah. Oh, it's
let me
much
say
bigger.
This. When you got the tip that something was going to go down, mm-hmm. you weren't expecting the fire and the deaths. When you say go down, you thought they were going to raid the place and bring Koresh out and that the kids who were inside were going to be, you know, taken out safely and all this stuff.
So, yeah, and so I got there early that morning, got on top of my scaffold. We had bean bags to hold the big lens, and I was shooting with a Canon video camera. We were pulling frame grab. So I'm a mile away in this beautiful land, just, you know, it's hilly, and up at the top was the Branch Davidians compound. I'm laying up there at probably 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning, and all of a sudden you see them come up with the tanks, and they started ramming the building and tearing it down. It wasn't anybody coming out with their hands up. They were, like, punching the building. And all of a sudden, it started to burn. And then you just start keep motoring and motoring and motoring. And all of a sudden, you got this mushroom just exploded. Boom.
Wow.
And, you know, and you just motor and hope you got it in focus.
Were you hearing gunfire?
No, I was too far away. I did hear the explosion. I was much farther away than the media side. The media side was probably half a mile away, but I was probably 2.5 because, I mean, it was a big swell, and they're up on a hill. But it was the most amazing view. But, you know, you realize that there were lives being lost. Once the smoke and the fire and the explosion, you knew it was going to be terrible. And it was what? How many people lost their lives?
80,
which what was 17 kids, I think. Yeah.
What did it feel like for you to watch that happen?
I mean, as a photojournalist, once you put your camera up to your face, you kind of detach yourself. I mean, it's strange. I could be at a funeral and I'm crying, but if I put my camera up and I'm working, it's like another mode. You're outside of it. So basically,
you're worried about, am I in focus?
Right. Your mind is engaged on, you know, you're watching history, but you're not thinking of that right then. You're like, you're trying to focus. You got to make sure everything's right, and you just get in the moment. Then afterwards, that's when it hits you, once you start looking at the images and seeing what went down. But, you know, it was very tragic for all the families involved.
And afterward, when you're looking at the images, and later, how did you ever process what you found or what you saw, or did you kind of just compartmentalize it, like, you know, so many photographers?
No, I think we all try to process it. I mean, when things go outside of the norm and chaos comes up, I'm getting it back now. Thanks, having my picture made. I did it earlier, you know, as a photographer. Now Naomi is hitting me and Smiley up. Yeah. So now.
But, a lot of iPhones up in this room right now.
So as a photographer, I mean, you and Smiley can do it. I mean, he was at Hurricane Katrina. I mean, we saw all these things, all these bad images. You process it. I don't even think you never get over it. I mean, I always think of Branch Davidian. I think of Wake, the Merrill Building in Oklahoma City. You know, I see my images. I know. I mean, you know exactly where you were, what you were doing, all these pictures when they come back up.
Yeah, which is why I think it was kind of powerful to, you know, having not covered that event, to go walk across the site now, you know, decades removed. Aside from the memorial, you would never know anything had happened there.
No.
There's no evidence of the ground being torched or anything.
The big building, the big compound that we all remember, you know, there hasn't been anything built in its place. There's some mobile homes. There is
a chapel.
There's a chapel. The place where it happened, where the chapel is, it's just grass. And there are a few bits of concrete. And it's really the only sign that something was there. And it reminds you that this is where something awful happened.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting when you do take the picture. It's over at the FBI. I mean, I stayed down there probably another 2.5 weeks. They won't let you in. Then they let you get closer. Then they let you get closer. Then they release the scene. Then you go in and take pictures of what's left. And I think I went back after, it may have been 5 years, when they had the chapel built and they had a service. Actually, they let the media in, and that was pretty interesting, because the service, I mean, it was so packed. It's a little chapel, but you can imagine thousands of people there outside and everything, and it was pretty interesting. So to see them rebuild, I mean, just lives, and, you know, they were following the guy who thought he was the one, you know, and it's difficult for some people to realize, but some people get caught up in a terrible situation.
Well, and that guy, that was where it was very interesting, sitting in the sheriff's office talking about it, because he went straight to, yeah, that guy, I knew that guy. That guy was a punk.
He was a punk and a child molester.
Yep.
That's, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, not some mythical figure, not some, you know, not some great, you know, historical moment in history. He went straight to, that dude showed up in town. He was a punk and a child molester.
And, you know, Professor Darden at Baylor knew Koresh too. And at one point, he didn't know, not they weren't friends. He just, you know, like you run into people in town. And Professor Darden at that point was freelancing for Billboard magazine. And Koresh had given him some cassette tapes, hoping that Darden would pass them on to, you know, music producers in Nashville. And apparently the music was really, really bad. And I should, Darden wrote a book about the standoff and was there out at the scene too, and how he has some, you know, really compelling stories to tell as well.
Well, and on the subject of going back to the site, that was where the old and the new really met for us. Because, okay, Irwin's picture is one of a few really good angles of the fireball that is etched in memory. You know, it's going to be on the Wikipedia forever if you look at Waco. You know, these sorts of things. You know, that's the image people have in their head. So you go out to the site now on a – that was the second day we were working on this story. And we went, it was a beautiful blue sky, lovely day, birds chirping, you know, just a lovely day. And so we run into these two guys who are just – kind of looking around. Well, three at first, but two. And so the two guys we run into are really, really nice guys to chat with. A couple of pilots from Kansas City who had, with their off day while they had some time in Waco, had been making the rounds. So they'd gone over to Twin Peaks and they'd gone out to the Davidian site, while their customers, where the people who they had flown from Kansas City, were at Magnolia Market. So this is somebody who can charter a private plane and go to Magnolia Market. So here it was, the two met, you know, standing out there in the grass, kicking at the ground, looking for, you know, evidence where the foundation had been on the building. And so here you go. But they had just flown some people who obviously had means to go see Chip and Joanna's place.
And it's the parallel tours of Waco.
Mm-hmm.
Do they still have the memorial little stones with the plants?
The memorial is still there.
Yeah.
There's one memorial in the center, and then there is, on each side, there's all the names.
Okay.
And then on top of the memorial, there were little rocks and coins.
Hmm. Interesting. Not all is bad in Waco, though. My daughter goes to Baylor, and I had a chance to pick her up just last week, and I saw a nice picture of Smiley's at a health camp, and it's not healthy, but we went by there, and that's where I'm going to be stopping. You want to talk about that?
We went there to talk to people, and the people were so nice, and they were just chit-chatting about all kinds of things. They closed, and we didn't get to eat any food.
Oh, my goodness.
We had to go to Schlotzky's on the way home.
The shakes and the hamburgers are awesome at the health camp. It's nothing healthy about the health camp.
And, you know, there's more things. You know, we went to see the Baylor Bears. There are actual bears at Baylor you can go see. And, you know, they're there and laying there, playing there, drinking water. They're really cute. Where there was actually only one on display. And then there's this beautiful park called Cameron Park. And we went up to this area called Lover's Leap, and there's this beautiful scenic drop-off. And you look at it, and you're like, this is Waco? You know, it's all about dichotomies. And Waco is a true study in dichotomies. It's the marriage of the terrible and the trendy. That's all for us today. Thanks for listening. You'll hear the latest Hashing It Out in just a moment. Stay tuned to DallasNews.com for more coverage of criminal justice issues. Remember to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. We are at Texas Crimecast. Thanks to our sound engineer, Tommy Noel. For Naomi Martin, Smiley Poole, and Erwin Thompson, I'm Jen Emily. We hope you stay safe out there. Now, we drop the mic.
It's easy to say now, with about a year's worth of hindsight, how poorly law enforcement and the justice system in Waco handled the Twin Peaks biker shootout. Of course, it was pretty easy to say that months ago, too. A confederation of clubs meeting at your local bar and restaurants means bikers from all over Texas descending on your town. Some perhaps with ill intent, guns, knives, other weapons, who knows. Prepare for the worst. And then something sparks it. A biker starts shooting, then two, then chaos. Waco police eventually regained order, but not before firing a reported 12 rifle shots into the melee. 9 people died, others were injured. How many from police gunfire? You still don't know, officially. Some reports say it was at least 4. A judge's gag order either prevents disclosure or provides a handy shield. Police also were accused of denying medical help to wounded bikers dying in the parking lot. They arrested 177 people, many unarmed and guilty of no more than being in the wrong place at the wrong time. A JP set bail for each at $1 million, absurd on its face because he didn't like all these outsiders coming to his town. 1 year later, despite more than 100 ham sandwich indictments, no one has been brought to trial. Imagine this happening to another class of people legally assembling. Women, gays, blacks, Hispanics, accountants, ministers, truck drivers. You know, another class of Americans with rights.